All right, time for Dirk. Dirk Chatelain of the World Herald joins us. Good snowy Friday afternoon, sir. How are you?
Doing well. Just got done playing golf and getting ready to go play tennis outside. So it's an active Friday.
Well, I'm glad we could catch you at your resort down in Florida. So thanks for taking time to join us. Hey, so there's a lot of stuff that went on. This was a busy week. It's great for all of us that are in the business, so we have stuff to talk about. But we've talked a lot about LeBron James and the stuff that he has contributed to the game of basketball with his excellence on the floor. And then he made the transition while he was playing with Miami. He was more active with issues off the floor. But looking at James Harden this week in forcing his way out of Houston to Brooklyn, when we get done and we make the announcement of LeBron James going into the Basketball Hall of Fame and you go through all of his accomplishments, should there be a line on there that says he gave power to players?
Wow. That's a good question. That's a good point. I think for as much, criticism as he received back in 2010, making his decision, that was just a normal free agent decision. Mm-hmm. That wasn't walking out of a training camp or basically boycotting as Anthony Davis did. I think it's a fair point. I think, whether he was directly responsible or just sort of, created new expectations. I certainly think, with the power, with the influence that these players have and the talent that they have, it's reasonable that they have a larger say in comparison to ownership. And I think James is largely responsible for that. Some of this goes too far. I mean, If you go ask John Wall what he thinks of James Harden, I don't think you're going to get a very positive response. And DeMarcus Cousins would feel the same way. And I think some of this, is just petty. And I will be rooting as hard as anybody against James Harden and Kyrie Irving. But it is interesting how, players have most of the power at this point to dictate not only that they don't want to play for their team, but also kind of where they do want to play.
Yep.
And I'm not sure that, I'm not sure we want the pendulum to swing a whole lot farther than it is right now, but it has changed dramatically in the last 10 years.
Well, I'm glad we're on board of we all need a villain in our sports to root against, and Brooklyn has now filled the bill of being the villain team. I can't believe that on that team, Kevin Durant would come out as the most likable guy of the three. Who would have thought that?
And probably he might be the least sensitive too. But that's the thing that drives me nuts about those guys. It's not just their style, but it's also just how thin-skinned they are. That's something that I appreciate about James is that he's received a lot of criticism and scrutiny over the years, and he typically doesn't, resort to the little tantrums that Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving especially, and James Harden is just sort of aloof. But it's a fascinating experiment. I mean, even if you're not an NBA fan, I think you have to be interested in the idea of three of the top five offensive players in the league, mm-hmm. top 10 at the worst, be on the same team. I mean, it's the ultimate experiment in, whether there's enough basketball, enough shots on the floor for a lineup like that. I certainly would not like to beat Joe Harris. I don't think Joe Harris is going to get a lot of shots down the stretch.
No, or Steve Nash when things go wrong.
Put it this way. I think that the Giannis Antetokounmpo model, which feels sort of antiquated at this point, right? Small market guy, signs long-term with his team, builds pretty organically around him. I think for old school basketball fans, there's going to be a lot of people rooting for the Milwaukee Bucks in contrast to some of the other contenders in the NBA right now.
Well, they will be, they're already playing a lot of national games, but they will be a must-watch on League Pass. I mean, they're going to play 160 to 150 games because they're not going to have a real interest in playing on defense, especially the newest guy that they acquired.
It's good stuff. I know that.
How many colleges in this country right now, if Urban Meyer doesn't go to the NFL, and he said it's an ideal job for him, he's very smart. You know, he scouts out where he's going. He gets the power. He's walking into good situations, which, you know, in the NFL, if you're going to walk into a situation, Jacksonville seems pretty good. You're getting the first pick. You've got a lot of money to spend. You got an owner who is basically turning the franchise over to you. But in the college game, would there be any schools you could think of, unless you had an established Nick Saban at your university, that would turn down Urban Meyer saying, hey, I'll come to your school and coach?
Well, the first point you make is good, because I think that I think Jacksonville, you know, it's the closest thing you can get to a college market in the NBA. And so, you know, the other thing that's probably appealing to Urban is there's going to be less scrutiny, I think, of him there. There's going to be more, you know, just genuine excitement that he's part of it. It's not a longstanding NFL fan base, you know, that goes back 50 years. So I think that, you know, he's going to get probably a longer leash there than he would if he went to the Jets or, you know, certainly the Cowboys or someplace like that. But, you know, and I think that the draft assets and the free agent, you know, flexibility is got to be appealing to him. I also think that it's pretty safe in terms of his legacy. I mean, if it doesn't work out, I don't think people, college football fans especially, are going to think of Urban Meyer much differently than they do right now. Whereas if he went to Texas or USC and, you know, didn't get to the top of the mountain, I think that might affect the way that people thought of him historically. So I think it's sort of a no-lose proposition, I think. You know, you mentioned sort of where he stands and Nick Saban, and it is interesting how those, you know, two guys, I think, who, you know, are the one and two in their generation of college football coaches, how everybody else, so many of the other top programs have really struggled to identify and keep a long-term coach like that. You know, Michigan thought they had it in Harbaugh. Nebraska thought they, you know, still think they have it in Frost. But there's so many guys. I mean, is Lincoln Riley really going to be a long-term guy at Oklahoma? I don't think so. I mean, I think he'll probably go another 5 years and then try to make the jump, or maybe even less than that. You know, USC is constantly looking. Texas is constantly looking. Clemson stumbled into it. You know, and I think they're, you know, Dabo's probably going to stay, but there's just not that many programs that have established a guy who is willing to stay long-term. I mean, there's even the Bob Stoops, you know, Stoops did what, 18 years at Oklahoma, something like that, 15 years. And, you know, he decided he didn't want to go longer. I just think it's really interesting how, you know, it's sort of become more like the NFL, where these guys are constantly looking for the next thing. And the trend that we keep hearing about is that because of the transfer portal and not only recruiting, you know, 16 and 17 year old kids, but also having to recruit your own 21 and 22 year old, that more college coaches are going to be making, you know, the jump to the NFL. And I think that creates all sorts of interesting ripples. But I think, you know, all things considered, Urban Meyer made a pretty good decision. This is I don't think there's a lot of downside to this.
Yeah. I think there's, you know, look at the college football coaches are getting younger and younger. I mean, Scott Frost is relatively young, mid-40s. Lincoln Riley is a young head coach. So they could go and be at a respective school for 7, 8, 10 years. They're still young. They could go to the NFL, do 4 or 5 years. It doesn't work out. They can still come back to college. I agree with your point. I think when Kirk Ferentz is finally done at Iowa, I mean, next year will be his 23rd year as the head coach at Iowa. I don't think in our lifetime, I don't think we're going to see that again. Somebody that is at a Power 5 school for that long. I think it's probably the shelf life of 8 to 10 years, and you move on to another job in college, or you go and you see if you can do it in the NFL.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of, I mean, it's I think society in general has moved in this direction. You know, people are moving houses more often. They're moving jobs more often. Yeah. They're moving towns more often. You know, I think that it's just not quite as much appeal to just sitting in one spot, the way that Tom Osborne did or mm-hmm. Bill Snyder did. You know, and that's, and you're right, it has become more of a young man's game. It reminds me a little bit of, and I know you follow it, but if your listeners follow, you know, high school basketball at all, I mean, there was a generation of high school basketball coaches 20 years ago where everybody was in their 50s and 60s. And now it's everybody's, you know, with few exceptions, Doug Woodard and Tim Cannon and a few other guys. Most of those guys are in their 30s and 40s.
Yep.
I think it's become at that level, especially in college, it's become such a grind. I think largely because of roster composition, that it's just hard for these guys to want to stay in one spot. And you know, you reach a certain level, and your fan base wants a little bit more and a little bit more, and it just grinds on guys. I mean, you know, I'll give you another example. Mike Gundy, you know, 30 years ago, I think Mike Gundy would have been, you know, a lifer at Oklahoma State. You know, in contrast to that, he's still there, but he's perpetually unhappy. He's, you know, constantly looking for the next thing. I just think it's sort of the nature of the business right now. And you do get the you know, the rare outliers. I think Kirk Ferentz is an outlier. Pat Fitzgerald has been an outlier to this point. But it's just hard for these guys to stay in one place and to keep everybody happy, especially at a football school, right?
Yep,
especially
yep,
at a school with long-standing tradition. And that's, I think that's just the appetite for constant improvement.
Well, and there's, you know, I remember when I was much younger in this business and would do the Danny Neese show, and one night we were talking off air, and he said, man, I'm telling you, he goes, I don't know your business real well. He goes, but I think every 8 to 10 years we should all move on and try,
right,
you know, move somewhere else. Now, I didn't know that shortly thereafter he would talk about he was moving to Rutgers that never transpired, and he came back a couple more years. But essentially he was saying, at the time he said, you know, look, I think we've got Nebraska basketball in a good spot. I don't want to go up to the top of the mountain and then on the backside where people remember me as the 11-19 guy, not the guy that went to 4 straight NCAA tournaments. And you wonder about some of the more successful coaches that when they reach the top of the mountain, it's such then the grind to feed the beast over and over and over that you either you depart leaving it in a good spot, or you depart because you don't want to be that guy that's remembered as the 11-19 guy, not as the 19-11 guy 3 years earlier.
It's the George Costanza. You know, you're going to walk out on a high note. It'll be interesting when Saban decides to leave. I think it's in a strong enough place where he'll probably just quit after a national championship at some point. But I don't think he's probably immune to the anxiety of that. I'm sure he's worried that, you know, if he goes 10-4, Alabama fans are suddenly going to be upset. So, but you know, back to Urban Meyer, I just think the obvious point of fascination there is we know what losing, even the most infrequent losing, does to his. Does to his stress level and mental health, and
yep.
You know, what is he going to be like when he loses 42-17 to the Tennessee Titans? You know, I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see how he adapts to a level in which losing is just part of the game.
And you know, the reaction we saw at Ohio State when he would lose, some of those losses were shocking. Okay, you're not supposed to lose to Iowa. You're not supposed to lose to Purdue. Maybe it's, okay, we weren't expected to win. I can help myself, you know, adapt to it a little bit more, even though I can't deal with losing. But don't you think there's another part, and Urban Meyer's not the only one, that some people are just addicted to coaching. I mean, they can't ever leave it. They might leave it for a year, but they never get away from it. And it's almost like a drug to them that they've got to be coaching, and they've got to have a whistle around their neck, and they've got to be in front of young men and getting them to reach their highest level. I think Urban Meyer has an addiction, and it's coaching.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of guys like that. I think Bill Snyder was like that. I mean, I talked to Bill Snyder this week, and, you know, that's a guy who got out and was out for 5 or 6 years and came back, you know. I mean, came back in his 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree. I think some of these guys, you know, they get out and they realize that, okay, what's the purpose of retirement if I'm not enjoying retirement? And, you know, I think Stoops is an interesting case study in that, you know, what he'll end up doing. He certainly got another job, I think, left if he wants it. You know, he's got time to do that. That would be an interesting one to see if he ends up coming back. But it's, I think it's notable that Urban just feels the need to sort of get out and recharge his batteries and then come back. And, you know, to localize this, Gary, I don't talk to Scott Frost on a regular basis at all, but that's a guy that I worry about because, I mean, you know what this job means to him.
Yep.
You know how much, you know, emotional investment he's put into it. I mean, I remember telling somebody right after he got the job, the first week, I told a couple people, I said, well, you know, Nebraska got a guy who's frankly going to be willing to sacrifice everything and anything to win here. And man, it just it wears on you. I mean, yep. You worry about what that does to a guy after 5 or 10 years of that. So it's, I don't think anybody's immune to it. Like I said, especially at a football school.
Do you think T.O. was addicted to coaching?
Well, I think he had some other interests. I think in some ways he could convince himself that he was coaching in other ways. But I do think he regrets getting out when he did. I talked to him this week too, and I said something about, I made a Snyder comparison about, you know, how Bill came back in his 70s, and I've made that comment to Tom Osborne a couple different times. You know, what it would have been like had you stayed, or what it would have been like if you had taken another job after Nebraska. You know, there were some rumors out there that, you know, he was at least had been called about some other jobs. And I would guess that subconsciously, whether he would ever admit that or not, that he regrets not coaching later into his life. You know, I think
I'm with you.
He's missed it terribly. And while it getting out probably extended his life and kept him healthy, I think if you said, Tom, you can go back and you can spend those 6 years in Washington that you did, or you can spend those 6 years, you know, coaching at name your wild card program. I think he probably would have said, I would have preferred to spend that time in coaching.
I agree with you. I mean, the question I've always wanted to ask, and maybe he's answered it, is when you got the call in 07, instead of putting on a suit and tie, what if they said, hey, do you want to put on a whistle? What he would have done. But
that's actually I made that exact comment to him the other day, and he just kind of, you know, he kind of laughed it off or shrugged it off. But you know, you could tell that it really, I mean, you don't have to be a psychologist to consider what that must have been like for him to watch something that he had built to really an unprecedented level be deconstructed and destroyed. And, you know, he's standing there and looking for the next guy to build it when he probably thought he could have rebuilt it himself. So, and maybe, you know what, maybe if that had all happened, maybe if Bowden had been 10 years earlier and Paterno had been earlier and Snyder had been earlier and there had been a precedent for doing something like that.
Yeah.
Where those real old guys could stay in it, maybe Tom would have looked at it differently and said, hey, those guys are doing it. You know, they stuck around or they came back. Maybe he would have decided to do it too. But, you know, I think the way that he finished has enhanced his legacy, you know, to the point where where it's really difficult to find somebody in college football history who walked away when he did the way he did it. Mm-hmm. And I think coming back for 5 or 6 years, and if it doesn't go well, that might have dented his legacy a little bit. So there maybe is a silver lining to that part of it.
You wrote today, it's been 2 decades since Nebraska finished the year in the top 10. It's all right there, all factual. The current program has been a whirlwind of news this week. We usually don't get these weeks unless there's like a coaching change where you get constant day after day, there's something going on. But it has been 5 days straight of Nebraska football news. How would you sum up this week for the head guy with the additions, a subtraction on your staff, and then you were old and you stayed old on defense?
Yeah, I think the thing that jumps out to me is just the contrast between sort of the offensive mood and the defensive mood. And, you know, you've captured that well throughout the week, but this is going to be a defense that is deeper than any Nebraska defense in at least 10 years, maybe longer. That doesn't mean it's going to be dominant, but it's going to be extraordinarily deep, and it took some unique circumstances to make that happen. And on the flip side, you've got an offense that is still trying to figure out which way is north and which way to go. And I think that's a really interesting situation. I mean, you've got guys on defense that basically said, yes, we want to come back. We want to try this again. This last year was really, really hard. We had to sacrifice a lot as players, and it didn't go very well. We went 3-5, but we want to come back and try it again. And then on the offensive side, you've got guys that are leaving, and you've got a scheme that needs fixing. You have quarterback questions. I mean, it's crazy to think 3 years ago that you'd have this much uncertainty on the offensive side of the ball, mm-hmm. while the defense is in pretty good shape. You know, I don't think the defense is going to be Alabama or Georgia, but or even Northwestern, but it's probably going to be a top 20, top 25 defense. And I think the question that Scott Frost has to ask himself is, how much am I willing to modify the way we do things to sort of give Eric Shenander a chance to be the star in 2021? You know, how do I protect this defense? How do I change game strategy? How do I change our philosophy, our pace, all these different things to maybe win some of those games 21-17? And I think we could be in for a very interesting shift over the next 9 months as Scott Frost has to make some compromises with the way that he normally does things.
Wow, that would be quite the compromise, because you know how invested he is in his offense.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that I anticipate that. I just think those are questions that he's going to have to ask. And you know, he's also got to figure out whether he has, you know, his answer for quarterback. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's probably the biggest question on the entire roster is, you know, can Nebraska build around Adrian Martinez? I mean, it's the same thing we were asking 12 months ago, but it's, I don't think it's any less true than it was then. And, you know, I said the other day, we were talking about it on our World Herald podcast, that Nebraska is this high-risk, low-reward offense right now, and that's a terrible combination. You know, if you're going to be high-risk, you also need to be high-reward, and Nebraska is kind of the worst of both worlds.
Great stuff. I always enjoy it, Dirk. Have a great weekend.
Okay, take care. You too.
That's Dirk Chatelain, joins us every Friday. That's a good discussion. I hope you enjoy it. Dirk did write, as I was kind of alluding to, he wrote a story. It's first saw it online. The facts and figures: Nebraska football's top 10 drought. George has got his NBA minute coming up here in a little bit. There is some broadcasting news in Major League Baseball. You know, Len Casper goes from the Cubs TV booth to the radio booth for the White Sox. Traitor. Hey, John Chombi got hired. Boo got hired as the TV voice for the Cubs. I think it'd be great. Here's another one. You know, the Cubs went through a stretch of Harry Carey, where that's a fan essentially broadcasting your games. Cardinal fans have had you know, you had Jack Buck and Mike Shannon together forever. And then when Jack Buck left, Mike Shannon moved into the role. And if you've ever listened to Cardinal games on the radio, you know, you get the big signal now that they're back on, you know, they've been on KMOX, they went away, now they're back on KMOX, so you can hear it around here. Mike Shannon is the play-by-play guy. And Mike Shannon is a really, really nice guy. I've gotten to meet him numerous times in my lifetime. But he is a fan broadcasting Cardinal games. And it'll drive people crazy because they don't know what's going on. It was like Jim Zobel broadcasting Iowa football and basketball when I was a kid growing up, when I was following Iowa. Jim Zobel was a fan. And you knew that there was a big play happening, but you'd have no idea exactly what was going on. Sometimes with Mike Shannon, it's the same way. But fortunately, he's got one of the best in the business that sits next to him in John Rooney. But Mike Shannon has announced today that after this upcoming season, he'll retire as the St. Louis Cardinal broadcaster. He has been with the Cardinal organization for more than 60 years. Yet, so George, you gotta listen to a Cardinal broadcast. Mike Shannon is a fan. I mean, he's an ex-Cardinal who is a fan broadcasting the games. Get out of here. Get up. Get up. Get up. Get up. Get out of here. That's a heck of a career with the Cardinal organization. But after this year, he will retire. And I imagine John Rooney, who is a pros pro, who has worked for a couple of different major league teams, has been with the Cardinals for a while, that maybe he'll slide into that role. All right, George got his NBA minute coming up in a little bit. Some final thoughts. Plus, we'll chat about the AFC divisional games coming up in the last half hour of a Friday edition of the Gary Sharp Show on 1620 The Zone.